Hi, we're Visible, the wireless company with nothing to hide. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not into you. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, Evan. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. Welcome back to the show after 1 week away somewhere. It's good to see you.
Not sure where I was last week. Definitely somewhere important, though.
How can one even remember where they were last week? What is time?
We're focused on the now.
Yeah, who is on the show right here, right now, this week?
Right here, right now is Hannah Georges, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She is the author of the cover story in the most recent issue of The Atlantic. The headline of that story on the web is "Most Hollywood Writers' Rooms Look Nothing Like America." The headline in print was "The Unwritten Rules of Black TV." And the article is this big sweeping look at the history of writers' rooms on black TV shows, starting decades and decades ago, then running through the 90s up till today, and how streaming is impacting those dynamics. It's one of those pieces, I know you guys have read these before, that like very easily could have been a book. And I read it last week and was really blown away and wrote Hannah an email. And she was kind enough to come talk to me about the article, but then also she does a lot of criticism. So we talked about balancing criticism and reporting. And she's also reported a lot on Ethiopia. So we talked about that too.
I think people are probably aware at this point, but I should note that we are part of the Vox podcast network, who produces this show now, thanks to Vox.
And now here's Max with Hannah Georges.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, it's going good. This is the first in-person interview I have done for the Long Form Podcast in, I believe, a year and a half.
Oh, shit, I feel special.
You should feel special. I mean, you should feel that special, but I'm just very excited to be here with you and, like, literally here with you.
Yes, thank you for getting me also out of my home. Very much appreciated.
I feel like people are just going to have to sit with us because this is going to be a little awkward at times. We're in person.
Looking at one another in the face.
I know, there's eye contact happening. Like, it's a strange experience, but I think we should just go with it. Because I'm so excited to talk to you. You wrote this cover story for The Atlantic. I read it on Tuesday. I wrote you an email right afterwards. I was totally blown away by the piece, and I've been reading your stuff for a long time, and it felt to me like a culmination of a bunch of work that you have been doing for a while. Does that feel right? Am I off on that?
No, that feels right, and thank you. A lot of different things came together in this piece for me. And so what we did with the piece is essentially trace like 50 years worth of black TV history, kind of going back to Julia, the show led by Diane Carroll, is probably the earliest real touch point. And then kind of all the way through Sanford and Son, we get to the Cosby Show and the 90s shows that kind of came from that, all the sitcoms like A Different World, Living Single, Sister Sister, and then jump sort of a little bit to Shonda Rhimes and to the present day. And that was an adventure to distill. Well, it was an adventure to report, but it was a real adventure to distill into like 9,000 words.
Yeah, well, I mean, it felt like one of those pieces that was like, this could have been a book.
Oh, yeah. I thought that multiple times, and I think I told, I'm pretty sure I told my editors, I feel like this could be a book. I'm not saying it's a book I want to write. Actually, I would love to read it. you know, and at that point, it was just too far into the thing. I was like, no, we got it. We got to find a way to make all of this work.
Well, unfortunately, I think you were the obvious and perfect person to write that book. I don't think you can get farmed out to somebody else. But help me understand how you decided on the focus of the piece, which is really not on the stars of these shows, and instead is on the writers' rooms themselves, the like people behind the scenes. Because you had to pick a focus somewhere right. for this thing, otherwise it really would have been a book.
Right.
Why go behind the scenes?
Well, a couple different reasons. I think that in general, when we talk about representation, we talk about what we see on our screens. So, mm-hmm. right, we're talking about actors. We're talking about who, you know, are the lead characters, who, what are the storylines that they're getting. And I'm always interested in that. But I'm really, really interested in power. Not for myself, not to acquire, but like how it operates. And process, right? Like how the sausage gets made. All of that stuff is very interesting to me. And I had been thinking about that in some form for a long time, but especially since I did an oral history of Living Single in 2018 and heard from Yvette Lee Bowser, who's the creator of that show, about her experience getting the show onto the air and how in some ways it was a bit of a fluke, right? Like that there are so many little things that could have gone slightly differently mm-hmm. that would have led to us either not getting the show at all or getting a completely different version of it, right? That the character I most identified with almost didn't exist.
That's the lawyer from next door.
Oh, yeah. Maxine Shaw, attorney at law.
Why is Maxine Shaw your person on that show?
Also an inspiration for Jasmine Hughes at the New York Times. We just, you know, there's a whole, like, generation of young women who saw Maxine Shaw and were just like, she's cool, you know? She has it together, right? Like, that's a powerful lady.
Even though she's always, like, mooching off their food?
Oh, yes. Yeah, but I mean, I love the interplay of those two things, right? I love that she's, like, this badass lawyer who's, like, always, like, fighting for women's rights and, like, you know, like, has her, like, natural hair and is, like, beautiful and stylish and put together. And also, like, every other scene we, like, see her on the couch, like, eating somebody else's chips. It's just, it's great. So, but, you know, Living Single was my jam. And the idea that this character almost didn't exist and that it was a fight for her to exist was really interesting to me. And I was curious about what those kinds of decisions were for other shows. Like, how do those quick conversations or, you know, those kinds of struggles actually add up to form the entire TV landscape that we see?
One thing that I don't know that I would have been able to articulate before I read it was that there was this moment in the 90s in that Living Single era, which is also like a different world yeah. and Moesha and Sister Sister. There are all these shows and then they kind of went away.
Yeah.
Why did that happen and how connected was that to what was going on in these writers' rooms?
Right. So the biggest thing that happened that affected that was that the WB and UPN merged into the CW. And at that point, when that network was sort of trying to attract a very broad audience base, a very broad advertising base, because this is still like network model, broadcast model, advertising, right? That the dedication to all of these black shows and all of these smaller audiences kind of faded away. And what that meant is that as all of these shows started to disappear, the black writers who had been working on them often struggled to get jobs elsewhere because there was, and in some cases still is, this pervasive view that black writers can write for black shows, right? That they understand that, but that they can't write for the like broad or like mass audience shows, which is to say that they can't write white characters. And a couple of the people that I spoke with referred to that window of time, those several years. So I think we're talking like 2006, 2007 or so, you know, through 2012, honestly, 2014 even, as the Dark Ages.
Yeah, that phrase comes up again and again in the piece. And I mean, what were those writers doing during the Dark Ages? What moves were available to be made?
Well, some people just left altogether. Susan Fales Hill, who I spent a lot of time speaking with, who had been a writing apprentice on The Cosby Show and then lead writer, EP on A Different World, left TV writing altogether. So she was working on a book, like all of these different other things. But basically, it felt like there were not avenues to do the kind of work that she wanted to be doing. And a lot of people said that they either took a break or, you know, kind of tried to cobble together living doing other things or tried to do, you know, film or whatever it might be. And one of the things I would have loved to spend even more time on is kind of tracking down some of the people who left and stayed out of the industry, right? Who left during that period of time and didn't make their way back. What's in this negative space?
Right. Like, what are the careers and shows right. that we just didn't get because of that period?
Right. And it reminds me in a lot of ways of what happens when so many people leave journalism. You know, there have been all of these studies, right, about, in particular, women of color who leave after a certain window of time because there's just a ceiling that you hit, or because layoffs happen, or, you know, because there are all these barriers set up. And I'm so curious about what people do, the livings they make, and what we as an industry, as a country, as readers, also miss when they're gone.
Right. It's like there's just this whole world of work that never got made.
Right.
There are, it felt to me reading your piece, real parallels between this TV world and the journalism world. And does it feel that way to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In some ways, that made it easier to report. It made the conversations, there was a shorthand for certain kinds of dynamics that often I would get into in these conversations with writers, right? That, like, they didn't need to tell me that sometimes you can be in a room and it can feel like the person who's brought on to either be the diversity or attract the diversity doesn't have real power. Like, I'm familiar with that dynamic. So there was definitely that. And I also, you know, I was cognizant of that parallel. I'm still cognizant of it. And I also didn't want this story to feel like, you know, one big subtweet, right? Like, I have plenty of things to say about journalism, and I say them. You know, I wasn't kind of trying to backdoor a critique of the media into a story about TV. But they are very related.
There's this phrase that comes up early in the piece, negotiated authenticity, which, since I read it, has been rattling around in my head. Can you, maybe just before I ask you about it, can you sort of explain that idea and how it came up?
Yeah. One of the things that felt super closely tied is a phrase that Felicia D. Henderson, who was a writer on Family Matters and The Fresh Prince, and then went on to create Soul Food, that she described to me, which is this idea of negotiated authenticity, sort of the idea that a Black writer or Black writers would be brought on to kind of rubber stamp a show's, like, real Blackness, right? That they're the litmus tests for whether a storyline or a character or what have you is, like, the way that Black people really do things.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase in there is like, does that sound right?
Right. I remember she said that, and I was like, no. I've been there. And in some ways, you want to have a person like that in the room, or at least one or two or something, just so that the work doesn't feel completely off base. And also, oftentimes, being that person is incredibly demoralizing and exhausting, and also really limiting power-wise. You can only sort of object up until the point where you really ruffle feathers, and then it's like, calm down. We just brought you here to make sure that everything's good. We didn't bring you here to sort of have a very explicit say in what's going on.
Right, we were looking for a yes.
Correct, right. Or like a yes, but make this tiny, tiny, tiny cosmetic tweak, right? Not like upend what's going on. The storyline is wrong.
I realize this is a very general and also very naive question. But how does that show up in journalism, in your experience?
Oh, boy. I think one way that can show up is quite similar. It's having a draft of, say, a big story that maybe a white writer has worked on that's about Black subjects or something kind of tangentially related to Black people. Having a story like that go to multiple Black people on staff for a read, and then not really incorporating their critiques, if those critiques are beyond sort of like, well, let's change this one word, or let's change this sentence, or have we thought about citing this person here, right? That, like, if there are serious kind of structural or tonal or, you know, journalistic critiques that we have, that sometimes those are not considered thoroughly, even though obviously the work of doing this editing, doing this sometimes heavy lift of editing is quite taxing. Like, not just emotionally, sure, but also just like we have other work to be doing. And so that can feel demoralizing and is certainly a position that I've been in and friends have been in before.
Other work to be doing, but also that's not the work.
Right, 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 exactly.
And I feel like that's a point you make really clearly in the piece, is that it's what's lost is not just this version of the rubber stamping, but that takes time away from just being able to do the work that someone is there to do.
Right, right. It's like I would much rather be thinking about what the next story I'm going to be working on is, right? And like not necessarily thinking about, you know, how to best phrase my critique of this thing so that it's accepted by the editors who are working on it and that they relate in a way that's accepted to the white writer, right? All these levels of like contorting thoughts and critique that may or may not be taken are, again, like sort of demoralizing on their own, but really distract from like creative work. And that's something that also applies in TV, certainly, because it's creative work, right? It's work that requires you to be not just working hard, but also present in a way that can sometimes be thrown off by this.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
You had done this oral history of living single. You had started to talk to people about these ideas and particularly what was going on behind the scenes. What was the moment where you were like, I'm going to write my 9,000 word thing that could also be a book? Like, was there an impetus to do this story now?
I don't think I ever thought I'm going to make this 9,000 words and it could be a book. I think we sort of fell into that one. But the point at which this came together as a story, as something that was going to be sort of deeply reported, was very much, I think, late last summer, maybe early in the fall, in conversations with my editors, in part because a bunch of us were noticing after, you know, the summer of reckoning, all of these, not just public statements about Black Lives Matter from every company in the world, it seemed, but all of these streaming sites and just various entertainment hubs having like a Black Lives Matter stories collection or like a Black Voices page or these landing pages where they were trying to really show off that they care about Black stories. And I was curious about what that looked like behind the scenes, right? Like, how did all of these shows come to be? And also, like, there's it's a lot of shows in this one page, and also, like, what percentage of your total catalog is this landing page? And so I was curious about the power dynamics inherent in that, and just remember feeling very strange and sort of, like, Twilight Zone-y about how suddenly there was this real push to assert and, like, constantly remind people of networks or streamers or cable channels' belief in Black voices.
Did it feel like bullshit?
A little bit. Kind of. I mean, it did. And, I mean, there have been some very interesting studies in the time since then about, like, corporate giving and all of the companies that pledged, you know, the money that they were going to give to social justice organizations and what's happened with that money.
It's
and
like the vast majority was, like, in the form of loans and investments.
Yep. Things that they could stand to profit off of. Yes. Not great. And I had a feeling back then that something like that was going to pan out in TV. But I was curious about whether these networks, whether the streamers that were really rushing to remind us how much they care about Black stories, what their commitment or lack thereof had been in the past.
What was it like to go from critiquing this work to reporting on how it was created? Like, I mean, obviously that Living Single oral history is a combination of kind of criticism and reporting, but so much of your work over the years has been relatively straightforward criticism, like responding to work that's out in the world. What was it like to shift to reporting on it?
It wasn't so much of, like, a technical or formal challenge as it was just mental, right? Like, I was very nervous that people whose work I had critiqued in the past wouldn't want to talk to me. That didn't even end up panning out, really, but I was anxious about it going in, and I was anxious about it going, you know, sending out press requests. That ended up being okay. But in the actual writing of it, I found myself almost overcorrecting a little bit. I felt like I wanted to make it clear that I was tracing a history and a formally reported story. So, like, I don't need to tell you what I thought about The Cosby Show. I'm just telling you what it was and what was going on and, like, how people experienced it. And so my editor, Colin Murphy, who bless him, at various points was like, you know, you can tell people, like, you could add a little more of your voice here. And I was like, okay, I guess. So that was a bit of a journey. But the reporting was fun and built off of some of that criticism. And I do in general, even when I'm working on criticism, try to make sure that I'm situating it within the landscape that it exists within, like, kind of its artistic and sort of social history. And so the instincts around the reporting were also pretty similar. It was mostly just, like, that the anxiety was very different.
Anxiety constant. Just a different formation.
Yeah.
Was anyone reluctant to talk to you for it?
Ooh. I mean, there are definitely people who, like, didn't answer my emails, and some of that is just, like, people being busy and having other stuff, and me, first of all, when I was reporting this, not knowing that it was going to be the cover, so I couldn't tell people for the cover story, right? And, like, that might have maybe...
But there's some risk. If you were still actively working in Hollywood, actively trying to get in writers' rooms,
absolutely.
There's some risk talking to you for this story.
Yeah, of course. And there were definitely conversations where people shied around mentioning specific names or specific incidents. And sometimes I didn't want to push that too hard just because, again, like, I'm a person in journalism who interacts with some similar dynamics sometimes, and I understand the professional risks inherent in talking about that.
This is the portion where I get you to name a bunch of names.
Oh, yeah. Okay, actually, I wrote them all down.
Do you have that, like, list of assholes that I asked you to bring?
Yeah. Can we put it in the show notes, too? Yeah. I didn't encounter too much of that, in part because we mostly kept it to bigger picture stuff.
I have two more questions for you about this piece, and then I want to talk to you about other stuff, but it's just, I'm so fascinated about it. One is, who did you feel like you were writing it for?
I think often the way that I answer that question is, who am I most anxious about? But when I say that, what I mean is that I want the people who I spend a lot of time talking with, the people whose experiences I'm trying to relay in a way that's accessible, in a way that feels like other people can understand what's going on. I want those people to feel like I did a good job of that, right? That I did it, like, accurately and fairly. I don't necessarily want them to feel like I painted them in a good or, like, positive light. That's a slightly different thing.
Well, how does that fit with Issa Rae tweeting, tattoo this article on my back? Which is one of the most incredible responses to an article I think I've ever seen.
I, Okay, at that point, I had logged off of Twitter for the day. Highly recommend. I think I tweeted this at like 9 or something, and I logged off by like 10. I was like, I can't do this. Twitter makes me incredibly anxious. You know, if anything big happens here, a friend will let me know.
Is that like standard practice for you?
Not always. Sometimes I'll log out like after a couple hours or whatever. But with this, I was just like, this is a big thing that's out into the world. And I know that there's probably nothing positive to come of me sitting here and like looking at the notifications tab. That's just not, it's not good for anybody. So I was made aware of that because multiple people like sent me the screenshot.
Yeah, that's some shit.
Yeah. And I mean, it was very flattering. It was, that's kind of exactly what you want to hear in a very vivid way. And, you know, I thought it was especially funny because I've been thinking for quite a long time about getting a back tattoo.
You were going to get a back tattoo of one of your articles?
Oh, yeah. It was like, how do we do 9,000? Okay, maybe we cut it down to 2,000. No. So it was very, very humbling, very flattering. But, yeah, I mean, I wanted people to feel like I had captured their experiences in a way that felt true to that. So that's one big bucket of things. And then I wanted people who aren't intimately familiar with these shows to feel like they got something from this that wasn't just a recounting of how they're, you know, how these shows that someone else might care about came to be. And then sort of the third bucket of thing that I wanted it to do is that I wanted somebody who'd known these shows or grown up watching them or was at least sort of had a cursory, you know, familiarity with them to feel like there was information that they were getting that was new or that was, you know, that shed light on something that they might not have known before or that they, you know, like left or thought that something was interesting or that there was still something in it for them too. And that was a lot of different things to kind of juggle.
Yeah, that feels like a really tricky Venn diagram, like the overlapping circles between like incredibly meaningful for Issa Rae.
Okay, that wasn't the thing that I was explicitly writing toward. But
I understand, but like you were saying that the people you had talked to, you wanted it to be representative and meaningful to them and their experience.
Yeah.
For people who have watched those shows but didn't have a whole lot of sense of what was happening behind the scenes, you wanted to be meaningful so they could learn something new. But then also, it's going on the cover of The Atlantic,
right.
And I don't know, but I'm making some assumptions about, I don't know what the percentage of Atlantic readers who are also like sister super fans,
right.
But it might not be super high. And that feels hard, like a hard needle to thread between those three things. How much are you holding those three ideas while you're putting the thing together?
All the time. I mean, I thought about it all the time. And, you know, that's part of what was really great about working with Cullen on this is that I think he was really helpful in helping me see the whole often because I would find myself either getting a little bit anxious about the, you know, the people who know these shows part or like I wasn't doing enough explanation for people who didn't know them. And the part about people's experiences being reflected, I think, was at once the most anxiety-inducing for me because we're also talking about people who are, you know, quite opinionated and quite online and quite, if they had issues, we're probably going to make them public, right? So there's that. But I was at once most anxious about that, I think, and also most comfortable knowing that, like, I had had a lot of conversations and that there were some really recurring patterns and that this stuff wasn't, you know, nobody's experience was really like a fluke or a super outlier, or there were things that happened that like didn't exactly fit into this pattern, but that I could point that out and that it would be okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's just like tactical parts of it too, which is just like, how much context do I have to give about Moesha here?
Literally, right? And like, how much do I need to explain about A Different World, right? How much do we need an explanation of what an HBCU is? Right, down to stuff like that, which is something that, like, I wouldn't think to do. And also, like, if I'm taking a step back and realizing this is in print, this is the cover story, maybe we do a quick gloss. I don't know. So there's a lot of that.
Part of the reason I asked that question is because I've seen that dynamic play out in some of the writing and reporting you have done about Ethiopia, too, which is there are these moments, like you did this piece, I think it was in 2016, about a guy who had come in second in the marathon of the Olympics and had used that opportunity to raise awareness and protest political dynamics in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And there's this section, like a third of the way into the piece, that's basically like, okay, here's Ethiopia. Like, this is where it is. This is like a very basic breakdown of who lives there, who's in power, how that happened. Like, it's like, here's like 500, maybe 700 words that's like, here's everything you actually need to know about Ethiopia. You've written a lot about that country, and I imagine also are trying to balance a lot of different audiences in those pieces. Like, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, chief among those audiences is my mother. Who does not like what I write about Ethiopia.
She doesn't?
No. Well, when I write about, like, political dynamics in Ethiopia, if I'm going to write about, like, Ethiopian food, it's a little less, you know, fraught for her. But I understand it. My mom came here in 81 during the Marxist regime that had overthrown the emperor, Haile Selassie, you know, during the period of time known as the Red Terror. Right, like not an easy period of time in the country's history, not a period of time in the country's history that was particularly open to the press. Not that our current moment is either, but I understand that there are some real fears and anxieties that she has about me doing this reporting, not just because of what it might mean for me, but for our family who's still there. And so, you know, I sort of always try to think about that, or I always have that in the back of my head, even when I believe really strongly in something. And that came up really recently in April. I published a piece about the current political landscape and some of the chaos at home. And I knew that she wasn't going to want me to write that piece. And I knew that I had to kind of ease her into the idea of it. And, you know, we had those conversations and she was cautious and all of these things. But there got to be a point with that story where I think it was January, so about 2.5 months into the current conflict, where I sort of looked around and realized that I'm one of, like, very, very few Ethiopian American staff writers at a, like, national publication. And I was like, well, regardless of whether or not I want to do this thing, and it, you know, there are certainly easier and, like, more fun ways to spend my time, it does feel like a bit of a responsibility. So at that point I was like, okay, I should start working on this, start figuring it out. But working on those kinds of stories is tough because it's setting myself up for, like, knowing that no matter how I do this, there's going to be some big demographic of people that is upset with me. There's just by virtue of what the thing is.
Right. Even if that demographic is a demographic of one.
Yep. And, like, you know, often by the time something publishes, she'll come around. Like, she was very nice about it when it actually did publish. And, you know, I think so it helped that, like, some of her friends had sent it to her and been like, we liked this. But it just, because the country and its diaspora and the region is just so fragmented politically, ethnically, and because there is so little in-depth reporting about it in international and Western press, it just means that you were often really set up to fail. Is it exactly the right word? But it's not far from the right word.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you'll notice, if you try to read, like, a Reuters or, like, an AP report about a specific battle or something that happened in Tigray, for example, like the northernmost region where a lot of this conflict has been happening. There's always that line, like, you know, halfway through or something where it'll say, like, you know, these claims are not independently verified by Reuters because, like, the communication lines are down. There's always something like that, right? There's always, like, there's a comms blackout, so, like, we couldn't quite, but this is what Amnesty International says. And so just structurally and, like, at the technical and, like, reporting level, it's just really hard to get information when people don't have access to their phone lines or...
I mean, it's an incredibly hostile place to journalists.
Yes. And there's also just so much, like, misinformation floating around, like, among, especially within the diaspora, because people are removed from their family members, but finding out bits and pieces of things from, like, their community centers or, like, WhatsApp or Facebook, all these places where all this stuff kind of thrives. Getting through to people is hard, even when you sort of have a set time that you're going to talk. Like, their phone lines might be down, or they might be ignoring you, or they might be in jail, right? Like, there's all of these different, like, really incredibly difficult things, just at the basic reporting level.
I gotta say, I'm surprised that your mother is a challenge in that thing. I just assumed reading it and, like...
Oh, no, I mean, I do it anyway.
No, I know. I just assumed before we talked that it would be a thing that you were doing in part because it made your parents proud, you know?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think for her it's a mix of that. I think it, you know, when we've talked about it, it's at once something that does make her proud and that she is certainly proud of, like, the instinct that I have to want to do it, that, you know, the fact that it is important to me is something that makes her proud. And also that sort of at a story by story level, because she has seen some of the ways that government suppression or that like even like interpersonal like strife or hostility has played out because of certain things that have been written or because of certain things that people have believed about one another, that she's nervous for like my safety, for our safety, for, you know, for all of those dynamics that are very much about like me, the person, as opposed to me, the reporter, which I appreciate because it helps, as much as it is a source of anxiety, it also helps keep me grounded.
She's your mom. She's like, she's thinking about risk.
Yeah. Yeah. And I understand it. And she also, I mean, she's more inclined toward safety and safety measures than I am just dispositionally. And also, it's true that like she grew up there and I didn't. Right. That there are some things where like I have to feel comfortable trusting her on something because like she does actually know it better. And like, yes, I'm reporting things out. And yes, I'm having tons of conversations with people. And also like I wasn't there in, you know, 74 or 75 when she had to like duck in the backseat of her dad's car. Right. Like I just wasn't I don't have that set of knowledge.
Or that like visceral memory.
Yeah,
and
right.
Trauma.
That sort of like embodied understanding of what it could mean and look like. And so. You know, sometimes I have to pull back my, like, reporter hubris a little bit and just let my mom have it.
This week on The Pitch, it's tween time.
We're redefining feminine hygiene for tweens.
You've done 5 million in sales. You did 3 million last year. Very impressive.
Thank you.
I really believe in this category. I'm an investor in a company called Aunt Float.
And similarly, I'm a personal investor in Ruby Love.
Like Elizabeth and Charles, I have seen a lot of these companies. Mm-hmm. I've never made an investment in the space. You should be raising more than $500,000.
As a Black woman, for me to come on here and say, I'm going to become the new Always, that's super audacious. And I could
Love
we,
Always.
For sure.
What makes it audacious?
Yeah,
it
let's do it. Let's
do it. You want to. That's what I wanted to hear.
I get the sense back her experience might have been a little different.
Save the mic.
That looked really expensive.
This week on The Pitch, Monica Williams drops the mic. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
What do you think that you're like trying to figure out about the place, or is there some sort of like longer term thing that you're trying to kind of grapple with or wrap your hands around?
Yeah, I mean, I think I am like a lot of first gen kids, a very like big diaspora cliche. But like, you know, I'm trying to figure out what people's relationship to home is, what mine is, what our family's is. But beyond kind of the like bad diaspora poetry side of things, the like mangoes and oceans. beyond that, I am really, really curious about how a country's history informs the way that people interact with one another in the day to day. And with Ethiopia in particular, because there is so much national mythology around the idea of this like never colonized, this like African bastion of resistance, this, I mean, we have like it is hard to contend often with the way that people prioritize the idea of Ethiopia and its historic meaning and its significance and symbolism within the diaspora, like the broader diaspora, with how they respond to the experiences of Ethiopian people. And that tension I'm really interested in, both in the ways that it shows up outside of the country and the ways that it shows up inside the country. Like, people are very, very, very patriotic, very nationalistic. And I'm always curious about where that comes from and how people grapple with that, even when it seems like the nation is itself a hostile entity, or like is an entity that leaves out so many people, or that can only exist because it extinguishes certain kinds of like indigenous practices, or like all of that stuff operates there in a way that brings in like language, religion, culture, all of these things that don't always get brought into stories about like Ethiopia, this country that like is, you know, a U.S. ally in the Horde, that is like an ancient republic where everybody's Christian. And like, there's so many myths about the country that I do find it like intellectually satisfying to get through some of that.
Is that a tension for you too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up believing and like hearing those myths because I grew up in a very like Christian household in Southern California, where most of the Ethiopian people I interacted with were also Christian, often from pretty specific parts of the country. And so you know, I got older and met people from other parts of the country, spent a lot more time with Eritrean people, with Somali people, and just kind of learning about Ethiopia, not just as potentially not colonized, but also as like an agent of empire itself, was just like very, very jarring. And then also kind of instilled in me a sense of responsibility to start with the little bits of power influence that I might have within our community, kind of start teasing that out and start having conversations with people about the fact that like, we can have pride in this place, and also like maybe that pride doesn't need to be contingent upon this vision of ourselves as like the sole African victors or what have you.
Aside from your mom, like how much do you think about the response to this reporting that you're doing?
Ooh, a lot. With this most recent piece, I like when I tweeted it for the first time, I set my replies to be like only people I follow. Because like you see that there is a tremendously vitriolic response if you have from really sort of any side, and that there are like actually like active digital campaigns to like suppress people and harass people, especially women. So I remain very aware of that, and I didn't get too much of it, I think in part because I did that, and also because I asked like the Atlantic social team to not, you know, include my Twitter name like when they posted it, so that wasn't coming in via their accounts. But seeing the response to other people's writing can be really, really, really stressful.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I listened to this interview you did like very, very, very early in the run of Another Round.
Oh, my God.
From like 2015.
Yeah.
And a lot of the interview is about your Tumblr.
Oh, I was hoping we would get here. Okay.
I want to ask you about your Tumblr. Which is an incredibly successful Tumblr, which we should talk about. But I won't ask you about it. But the thing that I actually was struck by in that conversation was how much you were thinking then about sort of not wanting things to go viral because of what level of response it was going to get.
Oh, yeah.
For you personally.
Yikes. And that would have been like 6 years ago, huh?
Yeah. So it's interesting that like 6 years later, the way that manifests is like, please don't put my handle in the tweet.
right. And I just being online and getting attention online as a Black woman is frequently unpleasant. And I mean, I thought about that with the cover story that like, thankfully, to my understanding, it has not reached sort of racist corners of the internet yet, like knock on wood. But that there are ways that all sorts of benign things can reach corners where people are just going to dislike you because of who you are, or like not understand that that's why they're reacting from such an intense place. But I think about that a lot, and it has influenced the times when like I've deactivated Twitter for a couple months at a time, or just sort of taken a break from being online, from being present. It's the part of being forward-facing, public-facing, what have you, is sort of the part of the job I like the least. It's the hardest thing for me.
But does it feel like you can't do the job without doing that?
Sometimes. I mean, I have done it before, right? Like, I've deactivated, I've taken time away. I think I am much more able to do it now as a staff writer than I would be if I were freelancing still. And that's, you know, a mental and emotional and psychological tax that I think we often don't talk about enough when we're talking about some of the labor stuff within our industry.
What do you mean?
I think that there is a bit more freedom that people who have salaried jobs at media publications have to step away from the grind and the constant intense tax of visibility. Like, there's more freedom there than if you are freelancing and somewhat dependent on that for your, you know, for the next thing that you pitch or for, like, editors to notice you. Or there's just...
Which was a spot that you were in for a long time.
Yeah, but I was lucky in that when I was doing that, I was working full-time at a foundation at the time. So I didn't leave school thinking that I was going to end up in journalism, and here I am. But, yeah, I wasn't making a ton of money in nonprofit land, of course, but I knew that I could pay my rent. And it put me in the position to not have to only take gigs because I needed the money for that. And I just am really, really cognizant that, like, not everybody has that luxury. And some of the ways that not having that luxury shows up is by having to be more online, which is to say more at risk of harassment.
And there's just no way, at least that I can see, if you are a young, aspiring journalist in 2021 who's trying to make it, at least to start as a freelancer, to not be very online. Like, does that seem off to you? Is there a way to do it that I'm not seeing?
I think unless you have existing connections with editors, with institutions, with potential, like, alumni networks, then yeah, it would be really difficult.
Yeah.
It's bad. A moment of silence for online.
I don't even know what to say. It's just like, yeah, it's
weird. People are really weird. Like, people have come up to my sister, my little sister, and been like, oh, I recognize you from Hannah's Instagram. I hate that. I hate that so much. Right? That, like, some of the protectiveness is, like, yes, me being, like, anxious and, like, don't look at me. And, like, you know, some of it is that, sure. And also some of it is that, like, you know, some write things that sometimes for some reason make people mad, and also I have family members who are visible on my things, and that makes me nervous.
Yeah, but it's also like, you know, your mom gets nervous about your reporting on Ethiopia.
Right.
You get nervous about putting your sister on your Instagram.
Right. Oh, well, it's all like mother, like daughter.
All right, we need to stop talking about the internet, or I'm just going to feel worse.
Yes, great.
I have some career questions for you before I let you go.
Sure.
You have moved around a fair amount. You were at The Guardian.
Yeah. I was at The Guardian while I was still working in philanthropy. Like, I was a columnist on the side. I wasn't on staff there.
That seems like a lot of work.
It was. But I was, like, 23, 24. It was fine. I had
energy. You were a person with energy.
I would, like, go to the little coffee shop by my place, like, you know, after work and be like, I'm going to file this draft.
And was your ambition then to be a journalist?
No, I didn't know. I just liked writing. It was, you know, I liked, I don't know that I had a specific career ambition that I don't think at any point in my career I have known what the thing I want to do next is, or I have known to want the job that I would end up having next.
Is that changing, or is that so?
A little bit. I think, I mean, now that I've been in it for, like, several years, that's changed a bit, but it sort of does come from me leaving college and not thinking that I was going to be a journalist. It wasn't something that I thought about as, like, a career path.
When did that change?
I think probably when I was toward the tail end of my time at BuzzFeed, I figured, oh dear, they've got me. They've got me in this thing. Because that was my first full-time job in media. And I remember thinking, I remember telling my mom, actually, like, all right, I'm going to go try this thing. I'm 24. If it's a terrible idea, I don't have kids. You know, like, I don't have that much responsibility right now. If it's a terrible idea, we could probably figure it out. Like, right. It won't be the end of the world.
And how did that moment where you were like, oh, they've got me? How did that manifest? Was it like, oh, this is clearly what I want to be doing? Or was it like, well, now I'm in too deep?
No, unfortunately, it was the clearly this is what I want to be doing thing. I think it was actually when I was working on the Faiza Lilesa story about the marathoner. There was a moment where I think I remember being really, really tired because I was transcribing interviews that I had done in Amharic, which is technically my first language, but which I don't speak certainly with, like, I don't speak as well as I speak English. And certainly I don't interview in it as well as I interview in English. So I was transcribing those calls, which were like awkward, and Faith's second language is also Amharic. He speaks Afan Oromo as his first. And I was like, this is awkward and just like technically difficult. And also, like, I really love this. Like, there, I think I was, like, up late, like, transcribing, and I think I called my mom because, you know, Amharic's my first language, but there are words I just didn't learn as a five-year-old, right? Like, a three-year-old, whatever. So I remember calling her, like, hey, mom, like, what's Ambagannon? She was like, oh, dictatorship. And I was like, ah, yes, yes. Classic. but I was just like, this is great. And it's kind of wild to me that, like, I am getting to learn this and to do this and to feel tired, sure, but, like, for work. Like, I am actually getting paid for this. This isn't the thing that I'm doing as like a passion project on the side.
Right. It wasn't like, it didn't totally feel like a job, even though it was a job.
Right. Right.
Which is a decent sign that you have found something that you like
exactly,
doing.
Exactly.
So why take the job at The Ringer, which you were the special projects editor?
I was special projects editor.
Which is very different than person who will be transcribing late at night. Why?
Yes.
Why did you make that shift?
Well, there was a lot of work that I was doing at BuzzFeed that wasn't just writing, right? That was, we had kind of like a Slack channel, working group of people who were doing or coming up with ideas or editing things for the content that we were doing, primarily for like audiences of color, for Black audiences. So I remember doing like a lot in that Slack and helping people and kind of like side reading stuff and like ghost reading things for friends. And like, you know, I was doing kind of a lot of background editing both at work and just because I have friends who are writers. And I thought, you know, like, I like doing this a lot. I like thinking about how this industry can elevate, like, the voices and ideas of people that it doesn't necessarily always pay attention to. Maybe I could take a crack at doing that for my day-to-day work. And so, yeah, I, like, helped think of what project ideas we could do at The Ringer, which was interesting because The Ringer is so heavily known for sports stuff. And so doing really culture-oriented things was sometimes difficult because the audience wasn't always into that. It was sort of like, this is fine, but where's my, like, Ringer NBA? Which, like, fine. I get it. But I did really, really enjoy working with Justin Charity and Micah Peters, who I edited pretty regularly when I was there.
So why'd you leave?
Because I love thinking of the big picture stuff. I love working, actually, with writers and helping writers get something to the stage that feels the best for them. Like, I find that really rewarding. And I also do not enjoy, like, day-to-day content management, planning, management in general. I'm a bit of, like, a softie. And I don't like enforcing things with people. Mm-hmm. So it's partly that. And also just that, like, the sort of way that I ended up at The Atlantic is that my understanding is that various people had been kind of, like, floating my name in the background, but how it sort of panned out logistically is that The Atlantic was at the same WeWork as The Ringer back in, you know, this would have been 2017, 2018. And I just made friends with John Swansburg, who's an editor on the mag side, because we would always be in, like, the mail line together or something. We just, like, got coffee one day and we're chatting and blah, blah, blah.
So for people listening, the way that you find a new gig is just, like, get in the right WeWork.
So Jeff says, Jeff, our editor, will frequently say, like, joke that they just found me wandering the halls of the WeWork. And I'm like, you guys have to stop telling this story.
I mean, it's a joke, but also it's part of what's so fucked about this time that
yes,
we're living in right now.
Absolutely.
Those kinds of things.
You don't get that.
Can't happen.
Right. And that wasn't even me and Swansburg interacting, wasn't even a, like, you seem interesting, we should work with you type thing. It was like, we got coffee. I was like, I'm happy to send you a list of writers of color because, like, obviously The Atlantic can do more of that. And he was like, okay, cool. And I sent him that list. I guess he forwarded it to Jeff, who was like, oh, this is cool. Also, what's her deal? But none of that really would have happened in that clear of a way
right. If
it hadn't been for that, right? And maybe I still would have ended up here. Who knows? But that was certainly one amusing way of doing it.
Do you have a sense now of what kind of work you want to be doing going forward?
Some of it is just more feature writing stuff. I really, really enjoy reporting. Really, really enjoy it. I mean, the most fun I've had at work is when, you know, I was doing the early reporting for this story and just spent my days calling people up and, like, talking with them about stuff that they were doing in the 90s. Like, I really, really enjoyed that. And not every story is going to have that tenor. And certainly there were parts of this that were difficult and not just, like, you know, talking about sister, sister, and the twins. But But I would certainly want to do more of that, including in ways that bring in historical stuff. I want to play around a little bit more with fiction, and specifically like romance stuff, which is like I love. And I think I've like read it for so long and loved it for so long and talked with romance novelists and written about rom-coms and like have almost like a meet cute premise generator in my brain. Like, I'll be walking through the street, and I think New York is just great for that, right? But I'll like see people interact in a certain way, and I'm like, oh my god, what if it starts there? And I also really would love to do the topic or like issue or set of things that I found myself really struggling to approach in journalism or in nonfiction has been just like the Mediterranean migrant routes coming from like Ethiopia, but especially like Eritrea, Sudan, through Libya. Just like it's a really treacherous journey, and I've like had some conversations with people who've done it before, but like I find that I really struggle with that gravity in nonfiction, and I wonder if there's a way of rendering that somehow in fiction that could be better or could be more like revelatory or helpful or like more of an ethical way of handling people's stories.
Oh, that's so interesting. I don't think I've ever heard someone bring ethics into that kind of idea before.
Yeah, some of it is just, you know, it's just my mom in the back of my head, right? Or like a phantom guest today.
I can call her after this. I think
it's best that we not. the reason that I say that is that there are things about traumatic migration stories in particular that oftentimes people don't necessarily want associated with their names or want put out into the world with their faces or with things that can be easily tied to them or their families or for all sorts of reasons. And I wonder if giving people the freedom to talk through what they want to talk through, to relay some of that, and to also know that it's not going to be connected to them in a way that's beyond like, we'll change your name, but in a way that's a little different, could be more like collaborative, more ethical. I don't know. It's something I'm thinking through.
All right. Well, when you write that thing, you got to come back on. Okay. We'll talk about it.
We'll see you in 2045.
Hannah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Seth Kelly. Thanks to him. Thanks to Vox, of which we are now a part. And thanks to our friends, as always, at MailChimp. But thanks most of all to Hannah for coming in person and talking to me about her article. If you have not read it yet, go do that right now. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.